Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Thursday, August 29th. Mission accomplished. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers this week cleared out debris from the last residential lot in Lahaina. We'll learn more about the milestone and a three-day festival to help Maui be more food secure and the star power helping to make it happen. After years of negative headlines, the Boy Scouts of America is on the comeback trail. We'll hear about the state of scouting in Hawaii in the aftermath of big changes on the national level. And a national push for semiconductor manufacturing here in the U.S. enlists the University of Hawaii to the tune of $2 million. Plus, the Hawaii Bicycling League celebrates the 40-year history of its upcoming century ride.
PR comes from NPR stations. And from your part-time controller, U.S.-based staff helping nonprofits with their accounting, from bookkeeping to financial reporting and analysis to CFO services, yptc.com/NPR. This is NPR.
You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. 1,390. That's the final count for homes that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers helped to clear potentially toxic debris from the Lahaina neighborhoods that burned last fall. HPR reporter Catherine Kluwit-Pachtel joins us this morning with more. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning.
Yeah, so this is quite a milestone.
It is. It's a big milestone in the Lahaina fire debris cleanup process for these residential properties. I talked with U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Lieutenant Colonel Colin Jones yesterday, and I'll let him go ahead and tell us about it.
We actually hit 1,390 properties cleared out of 1,390. So I'm happy to announce we are at 100% as of yesterday evening, the 27th of August, when it comes to clearing personal private property. And so that's a huge milestone. It's been 8 months in the making. So four months earlier than maybe projected originally as the team worked to try to really determine the resources and how long it would actually take. So 8 months is very impressive for almost 1,400 properties cleared. And so we still have a little work to do before we say that those lots are ready to be handed over and what we call completed. So 1,278 out of the 1,390 are what we call completed, meaning the county has an administrative packet in hand and can begin working with the homeowner on the permitting process. So we still have 112 to get to the completion status. So what that looks like, though, is only 16 of those really have significant steps left to take before we can complete the administrative process, which is erosion control.
So what else is involved?
So after that, it's mostly runoff mitigation and the gravel on top, which signifies that process is complete, everything's cleared off, and like you said, it is ready to hand over to the account to the county to work with the homeowner if they, you know, are ready to move forward with rebuilding. And he said he anticipates about 3 weeks left to finish those final properties. And he said there are a few properties that they are still waiting on soil sampling results from the Department of Health. So once the initial step of the cleanup process is they scrape about 6 inches of soil off the top of the property, and then they send that soil in for testing. And a small percentage of the total lots, he said, came back with inconclusive results or showing higher levels of metals, contaminants. If they come back positive for any of those or inconclusive, then they scrape an additional 6 inches of soil off the top. And so he said they are still waiting on soil results for a few of those properties. And what comes next is the cleanup, finishing the cleanup of commercial properties. So Lieutenant Colonel Jones shared where they are with those commercial properties.
Commercial debris lots are sometimes a little more challenging because the acreage and the size of these lots are larger. There's some more complexities there when you're dealing with a lot more concrete steel beams, sometimes elevators, sometimes subsurface, you know, parking structures. There's some extra technical care that needs to go in into making sure that we safely remove the debris. And then of the 159 commercial properties, right now we have 91 cleared. So that's about 58%, I believe, cleared, and 69 of those are completed. So we're on trajectory, you know, to have a majority of the debris cleared by the end of the calendar year.
Yeah, I mean, they are making pretty good progress, you know, just going over there and seeing the difference in 6 months. Tremendous effort.
It is, for sure. You know, you see that gray gravel across Lahaina, and that signifies that, you know, it's really nearing the final home stretch of this part of the process. He said the commercial properties are scheduled to be fully completed by the end of February, so that's coming right up. And he did talk about those commercial properties taking a little bit extra time. He said, you know, a lot of them hold cultural and historical significance. There's a lot of sensitive areas there that will be closely monitored by archaeologists. And again, you know, taking a little bit more time on those properties. So he said it may seem like they're moving more slowly in this final step of the commercial debris removal, but they're really just, you know, trying to be really deliberate and sensitive to those culturally rich areas.
Yeah, and, you know, I know that they did clear the schools. You know, they're starting to do that, and I think they've discovered some ancient human remains. So, yeah, you've got to take care because those were burial sites.
For sure. The Kamehameha, King Kamehameha III Elementary School site has been cleared already, and I believe that's where some of those EV were found. And so, you know, it's just a good reminder that, again, taking it slow and being sensitive in those areas. And Lieutenant Colonel Jones also talked a lot about the local workforce that's been involved in this cleanup process. He said about 85% of the debris cleanup workforce at one point was Lahaina community members and local companies that were trained, invested in equipment to help with this process. And so he said they've really, you know, it's been amazing to watch the community step up and really be part of this cleanup process.
Yes.
And that will prepare them for, you know, any future need for work in the future as well.
Yeah, kudos to everybody involved. But thanks so much, Catherine.
Thank you.
That was HPR's Catherine Kluwet-Pachtel joining us with an update on the residential and commercial cleanup efforts in Lahaina. Food and music and a good cause. That's a combination that organizers of a three-day festival hope will draw community support. The money from the inaugural Maui Music and Food Experience fundraising event will go to help Maui in this next phase of recovery. Gary Gruby is with the Hua Momona Foundation, whose mission is to build food security. He splits his time between Maui and Chicago, and we caught up with him in the Windy City to talk about how this festival came about.
The Hua Momona Foundation has been around for several years on the west side of Maui, and it's been focusing on generally food insecurity. In particular, before the fires, we were giving away up like 24 tons of vegetables, basically, to the community by way of homeless shelters and also for people that were unsheltered. And then came the fires. So we sprang into action with our commercial kitchen, and then we upgraded to a larger one, actually, about halfway through the last 12 months. And we're doing about 1,000 free hot meals every week for the last year. And we're still doing it because there's still a food insecurity issue. So to bring attention to that and to frankly fund the ongoing efforts of our team and also our partners that help us get the food into the community, we thought, let's try something different. You know, let's have a multi-day event of concerts and fine food. And the relationship is that our farm has a executive chef, Zach Laidlaw, who appeared on Gordon Ramsay's Next Level Chef this spring and came down. Yeah, he was a finalist at the very end, placed very well. And he's been doing this for a long time and is really well known on Maui, not just at our farm curating, you know, farm-to-table dinners, but also for helping in charitable causes from time to time with his fellow chefs. It's quite an interesting collection that they've formed. And anyway, so that was a natural for us to think about, hey, well, what can you do with food? So we have recruited about half of the people, I think, from that Next Level Chef show. Actually, we have five chefs total from that. So any of the fans of that show, and that thing was widely watched this spring, you can meet all of them. And oh, they're wow. going to be cooking different things over the various days on this thing. So that's one element. And the other one is that by way of just networking, and, you know, it's all about who you know in your Ohana, and we've got several people from the Chicago area that where I grew up that are in the music business, producers, musicians, et cetera, people in the production business, theater. And I cherry-picked from all of those people that I know and said, hey, is there a way we could do a concert series out in Maui around the one-year anniversary mark to bring attention to, hey, we're still here, world, and, you know, we've got a lot of things to work through. We appreciate your early help, but it's going to be a long haul. And this concert series can help fund some of the activities that are going on directly and, you know, show the people out there some love that have gone through this the worst possible scenarios. So anyway, the music team, well connected in the industry. And I describe it like a ladder of bringing musicians onto the list. In the beginning, we started with a lot of the local bands that we know because we've had them at the farm or we've, you know, seen them play locally out there, like Marty Dredd, the reggae guy, mm-hmm. Jason Arcilla, who was on The Voice. And he's unbelievable. Brian Santana and his band, you know, he's the nephew of Carlos. He's an unbelievable, gifted guy. And we have several others, Gretchen Rhodes and her band. So we recruited all of them, and they know us really well over the years, you know, those performers on Maui, and they were signing up very quickly. So after that, we said, all right, now let's expand our horizons, and what can we do bigger? And we had the notion of recognizing the fact that Jimi Hendrix, who is still rated the number one guitar player of all times, of course, who, you know, was deceased back in 1970, 6 weeks after he came to Maui and played in Upcountry, July 30th, 1970, played a concert, and it was for a film that they were putting together called The Rainbow Bridge. The film by itself was a total failure, but the filming of the concert of the 200 people who attended for free, by the way, they sat them by their astrological sign. Mm-hmm. This was 1970. And they really had a great time. And if you see some of it, you can find it on YouTube. If you look up Jimi Hendrix Maui 1970 Voodoo Child, you will find the video. It's priceless. So anyway, we're thinking about that connection. And literally, we know people that moved to Maui because of Jimi Hendrix, you know, playing there in 1970. And we said, we're onto something here. And we said, is there any way we can tie this in? And so our music director, I'll reveal, is Nick Tremulous. He's a producer, musician, writer, the whole thing in Chicago, well-known for years. He knows everybody in the industry. He said, you know what? I think we can contact Billy Cox, who is the only remaining surviving member, right, of the band of Gypsies and played with Jimi Hendrix, you know, in the early days. And he was in Maui with Jimmy. He was in 1969 with Jimmy at Woodstock. They were the final act, you know, that went up. And so he reached out and they had a great conversation with Billy Cox and his wife, and they fell in love with the idea. And, you know, returning to Maui, he just has such great memories. And if you read the snippets here and there about his experience with Jimmy, they were only here for like 3 or 4 days around that time in 1970 and just discovered the paradise. And, you know, like shockingly from what I've read, my interpretation of, you know, hey, is this what paradise is like? Yeah, I think so. You know, yes. Real simple. And so they had a great time. They played at a local bar the night before in Lahaina, as it turns out. There's another like bizarre connection. I don't remember the name of the club. It's, of course, it was long gone before the fires, certainly, it was 1970. But they played there the night before just for fun, then their concert, you know, on July 30th. So Billy said, yeah, I'll come out, and I will, you know, all 3 days that you're thinking about doing it, I will show up, I will meet people, I will talk to people, I'll perform, whatever we want. I mean, he's all in. It's fantastic. All those guys back in the 70s and 60s, remember how rock formed? It really came out of blues. And so a lot of that was, guess what, Chicago and London, you know. And there was this London blues thing. And guess who was in the middle of that? Mick Fleetwood, you know, and a bunch of his cohorts back in the, you know, late 60s, right, for Fleetwood Mac was formed. So we didn't start with him. We started, you know, picking off some of the other musicians that understand that era. You know, they're not of the era that Billy Cox, that man is 82 years old and he still rocks it out and he's coming out. I know. So, you know, and he says, hey, you know, Gary, I can't carry all my bags anymore. I says, I'm going to bring some people. Is that okay? Yep, you bring them. You know, so.
Well, Mick Fleetwood, that's pretty good.
Yeah, he was the top of the ladder. He really was, you know. The best drummer in the world and highly recognized, but he was there in the beginning. Mick, in my estimation, understands all these connections and, you know, was so generous to say the same thing. I'm all in. I'll be there all 3 days. He's going to stay out at the host resort. People staying there. It's at the Ritz Resort on the west side of Maui. And it's just next to our farm. So it's a logical partner of ours and a wonderful venue for the Friday night galas. But yeah, Mick signed up as well, and he wanted to support the whole thing all 3 days and show up. And he'll be performing the last night at the big concert at the Mac Center there.
How do folks get tickets or get involved
if
they want to attend this festival?
Through our foundation, we set up all kinds of different packages for the over the 3 different days. And you can go in there and pick and choose from it. So we have a website, and I'll just mention it. It's a real long name, but it's real logical once you hear it. It's the Maui Music and Food Experience.org. Maui Music and Food Experience.org. But you go there and you can see the whole layout day by day, and people can sign up for tickets. And I will tell you a little secret promo code for your listeners to enjoy a 50% discount if they can get to the Ritz event. We're trying to fill that out. If you have 2 people that want to go to the Ritz event, that's the middle one on the 6th of September. Click on the event for the Ritz and go in there for where it says, hey, buy 2 tickets. If you put in the code, it's the year of when Jimmy and Billy were on Maui performing, 1970. That's the secret code.
Okay.
You put that in, you get 50% off. That's 2 for 1. That's a huge deal. And those are a little pricier there because that's a gala. So that's food, drink, I mean, the whole thing. It's, you know, it's for the cause. So
right.
There's a donation in there, of course. But the most economical thing is for people to buy tickets over at the Mac for that last day on the 7th. And there's a button to click on that, too. You can go in there and look at the pricing. It starts at $150.
But
sure, there are cheaper events there, but you'll never see one like this again.
Yes, so, and it's all for a good cause.
Yeah, the proceeds are going to, number one, continue to feed people food insecurity because it's a big issue. I mean, it's been a year, but still people are moving around in housing or they are multi-generations in one tiny little place with one tiny little kitchen. We're helping them, you know, by making these hot meals along with the other food hubs that are very important on the west side of Maui that provide non-perishables primarily, you know, and people can still go in there and pick them up.
All right.
Which is great. So food insecurity is going to be a big thing for a long time.
Okay, so people can help out with the cause, make a memory, and just have a good time with the music and
exactly.
The chefs.
We hope to fill it out. We're getting close.
And that was Gary Grube, founder of the Hua Momona Foundation and a force behind the 3-day fundraising festival. The Maui Music and Food Experience kicks off next week. And Grube says it will be giving away hundreds of free tickets for those who were directly affected by the Maui wildfires. The Makai Foundation is helping to facilitate that. Look for links on the conversation page of our website later today.
Let me take you out of my place where there's nothing but aloha. Let me see the smile on your face when we're driving out to Hana. The island breeze where the rivers meet, the white sand.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaiian Airlines, connecting Hawaii with international destinations including Japan, Australia, New Zealand, and South Korea. Schedules and reservations at hawaiianairlines.com/international.
Next in our special series, Elements of Energy, why Indonesia believes nickel could pave the way to political and economic independence.
We were colonized for 350 years. In the next 70 years, we are just still producing commodities, which was the reason why we were colonized. Something has to change.
The promise of nickel in our series, Elements of Energy, that's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
The Boy Scouts of America is looking to make a comeback after recent sex abuse claims and financial problems prompted massive changes within the 114-year-old organization. Here in Hawaii, the organization settled a lawsuit earlier this year filed by the family of an 11-year-old boy who died after he was accidentally shot by another child at Camp Honoka'ia on Hawaii Island 2 years ago. So what is the state of Boy Scouts in Hawaii today? Well, the Aloha Council oversees the scouting program in our islands, as well as in Guam and American Samoa. It was first established in 1914, 4 years after the national organization was formed. The Conversation's Russell Subiono sat down with the Aloha Council CEO, Blake Parsons, in our studio.
The Boy Scouts of America, which is now Scouting America, has seen some rough times recently. National headlines of sex abuse and financial problems. I know that earlier this year, a lawsuit was settled stemming from a child who died after accidentally being shot by another child back in 2022. How did these issues impact scouting here? What kind of lessons were learned? What kind of changes were implemented moving forward?
Sure. I appreciate you bringing that up. I can't speak to the details of all those incidents, but I can say this really made us look deep and make sure that we are providing a safe program for scouts and for adults across the entire program. So it's taken us looking top down at all of our outdoor programs, all of our activities, how we deliver it, how we register people. From a national perspective, I think one thing that we've done as far as youth protection is we make sure that everybody who comes into our program, all adults have a complete background check. They must go through youth protection. They must go through annual training. And that's before you even join the program. And those kind of key changes make sure that we're offering the safest, highest ethical standard program we can offer.
It sounds like there was a deep internal look at the way things have been done in the past and have changed in terms of moving forward. So where does Aloha Council stand today? What are the membership numbers? How many troops do we have in our state?
Sure. So we have about 4,000 members across the state, boys and girls, 4,000 youth members, about 2,000 adult volunteers, about 180 units or so across the state. So we're actually growing. You know, it's been a tough few years for scouts. There's no denying it, especially coming out of COVID where you had a lot of units who were trying to figure out what can we do? How can we meet? Or we have all these other priorities and really they're trying to stay safe and survive just like everybody else, trying to figure out what was happening in the world. And so even in the last year, we've had 10% year-over-year growth from May of 2024 over May of 2023. So we're happy to see that continued growth.
What is it about scouting do you think attracts more and more youth as time goes on?
No, I think it has a little bit of everything for everybody. So you have your outdoor programs and activities where people want to get outside. They want to get away from their phone. They want to participate in these, you know, go up to camp. They want to go camping. They want to ride bikes. There's all that that's in scouting. There's also the character development. And I think that comes from maybe the parent side. I don't know if youth are really looking when you're 8 years old or 12 years old, like, I'd like to build character.
Right.
But I think a lot of parents are looking for that. They're looking for programs that they can involve their youth or in their kids and, hey, what can we get them to do to make them better people, make them better citizens, make them leaders? And that's one of the key things that comes out of scouting that I think transcends time is that leadership ability. And that's something that Scouts really excels on.
There's no shortage of celebrities and leaders that were Boy Scouts at one time. People like Michael Jordan, Jack Black, Bill Gates, all at one point were Scouts. And you mentioned that your membership includes both boys and girls, that it has opened up to be more inclusive and allow for more youth to have these kinds of experiences. From what I can tell, the inclusion of girls became official in 2018. What has the organization seen since that decision? How have the organization and members benefited from that broader inclusion?
Sure. Well, I think the members love it. The units love it. From a parent perspective, I think that's really where it came out of. You know, they polled all of our members in 2018, and really that discussion started years before that. You know, do we allow girls in? It's Boy Scouts of America. Should girls be included in this program? And the resounding answer was yes, and I think for many reasons. But one, if you're a parent and you're able to take both of your kids to the same place, to this iconic program, and they can both participate, there's really no reason why they shouldn't. It's an awesome program. I mean, I'm an Eagle Scout. I grew up in scouting. Yeah, it would have seemed very foreign to me when I look back. And that was honestly my initial reaction way before I was even part of professional scouting or in this position. I was like, well, this doesn't make any sense. But then you started to realize that the kind of impact we could have on boys and girls in our state is amazing. And we love to see it. And I think one thing that we don't really talk about enough is the choice that units have to have, you know, in Cub Scouts, it can be co-ed, right? And then you get into Scouts BSA where it's, you know, basically 11 to 18 or so. The units can decide, do we want to have an all-boys troop? Do we want to have an all-girls troop? And just in the last month, we're actually doing a pilot nationally of combined boys and girls in the same unit. and be very interested to see how that interaction is going to work out.
Very interesting times for Scouting America. When we think about all the indoor activities and technology out there that capture the attention of our kids today, has scouting had to evolve to meet youth where they are? How does scouting still kind of foster a love of the outdoors and outdoor activities when there's so many things designed to keep kids indoors and sedentary?
We actually talked about this a lot. You know, in the last few months, we've rebranded or changed our name to Scouting America Aloha Council, or formerly Boy Scouts of America. And a lot of that discussion came out of what has not changed, right? We talk about, the change of the name, but the outdoor programs, the requirements, the what it takes to become an Eagle, the annual outdoor camping requirements, all that's the same, right? So I kind of say what hasn't evolved, and that iconic program is still the same. However, we have evolved in offering STEM programs, robotics. We've included all of that into scouting. So there is still, you know, to offer more programs to people, but still the iconic program that we all know.
It seems like there's opportunities for youth that have all types of interests. Maybe it's no longer just for kids who like the outdoors, but there are some things, some different things, like sure. You mentioned.
Yeah, I was actually at Camp Molohio in Maui during their summer camp earlier this year, and you know, they had a car out there with a mechanic, and he was teaching them auto mechanics right at the camp, and they were all changing tires, or there was an electrical engineer out there teaching them how to wire things up, and it was an awesome to see just a wide array of everything, basket weaving across the board of things that people could do.
What are your thoughts on the future of scouting and the Aloha Council? What is your hope for the organization and the way that it impacts our young people?
So we are on a major expansion initiative right now, and that really comes from our key volunteers and staff getting out and meeting more people at farmers markets, at schools, getting out there to explain what scouting is. I think one of the major issues with scouting in general is if you weren't part of the program when you were young or you didn't know what it was, for instance, sports. So I'm going to go join a sports team. And I say, sports, okay, well, I'm going to go to practice. And I'm going to play in a game. We go to practice. I'm going to play in a game. That's generally widely accepted. That's what everybody knows. But scouts, I'm going to join a den that's part of a pack that meets monthly or biweekly, and we're going to do ranking. A lot of people just don't understand the program, and that's our responsibility to get out there and kind of simplify it and help people understand what the commitment it is, what it's like to be part of the program. So you're going to see a large marketing or effort from us to get people to go to beascout.org to find units to simplify what it means to be part of it and simplify how to join.
If somebody's interested in joining Scouts, or if a parent has a child who thinks that Scouts would be beneficial to them, how do they go about getting more information? I imagine there's a website, but is there a place where they can go and talk to a person about how scouting works?
Yeah, so we have staff on each island, but we have an office on Honolulu. The key, easiest way to do it would be go to beascout.org to find a unit in your area. If you go to beascout.org, you type in your address, it'll say a unit's 1 mile away. It'll tell you their meeting time. It'll give you a local contact number and an email on how to get in touch with them. But I think one of the best ways is to find somebody who you know who was in scouting. There's, you know, that three ways of separation, or it's probably two ways of separation in the state. People who were in scouting or participated, talk to them. Find out what their experience was. What did it mean? What did you go through? And I think once you really connect with somebody who's been in the program and understands how the impact on it, it impacted me more than anything else in my life. And I think if you talk to somebody about that, it'll really help them understand what it means to be part of it.
Boy Scouts organization has been around since 1910. I've read that over 130 million young people have participated in that time. If there's somebody listening right now, what would you say to them? How would you encourage them to look into scouting?
Sure. I would encourage them to look into it by going to beascout.org to find out how you can join a local troop. If you were participating in scouting and you're an adult now, we encourage you to reach out to us. Go to scoutinghawaii.org. Email me at blake.parsons@scouting.org. We are looking for volunteers. We're looking for expertise. We're looking for donors across the board. Like, if you were impacted by scouting, reach out to me. I would love to have your help. We want to grow the program that you participated in, that you benefited in, and make sure that it's here for the next generation.
Blake Parsons, thanks so much for your time this morning, man. Really enjoyed talking to you.
Mahalo.
That was Boy Scouts of America's Aloha Council CEO, Blake Parsons. He was talking with HPR's Russell Subiono. The national organization officially changes its name to Scouting America in February of next year. The Aloha Council is actively recruiting for new scouts as students return back to the classroom. Look for a link to more information on the conversation page of our website later today.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply with a mission to provide fresh water to the people of Oahu, committed to conserving and protecting Oahu's water resources since 1929. BoardofWaterSupply.com.
This Saturday on The Real Deal, we'll be hearing from the likes of the Rolling Stones, Lou Reed, and other rock and pop artists. Why? They had great jazz folk soloing on their recordings. We'll hear from Miles Davis, Stan Getz, Joe Venuti, and many others. Join me, Seth Marco, Saturday night from 8 to 10 on HBR One.
The pandemic and a shortage of semiconductors opened the public's eyes to the fact that the tiny chips are a part of everything, from cars to computers to cell phones. President Biden went on to sign the Chips and Science Act, and it aims to strengthen the global supply chain of semiconductors and other microelectronics and boost production in the U.S. As part of a national $235 million initiative, the University of Hawaii at Manoa will be receiving $2 million to join a Northwest AI hub. The conversation's Maddie Bender spoke to UH Electrical and Computing Engineer professors Jeff Weldon and Boris Merman about their plans to use the funding to create an industry here in Hawaii. Weldon starts us off.
In class yesterday, I actually talked to the students about why we study what we're studying. And I pointed out that it's over $600 billion market worldwide for the semiconductors alone. And that's not talking about the technology that the semiconductors enable, cell phones, computers, cars, and so on. Just the sheer dollar amount is critical to worldwide infrastructure, no question. The other issue I see is that the public doesn't have a clear understanding of how important semiconductors are to their daily life. Semiconductors enable so many things in our daily life, yet you never see one. You can look at your phone and you don't see a semiconductor, you see a screen. You look at your computer, you don't see a semiconductor. Yet you peel back the layers and they're everywhere, enabling all of our technology. And so people don't really know what they are. And then all of a sudden, there's talk about a shortage and they can't get a laptop or a phone or a car or something like this. And now they're thinking, if there's a shortage of toilet paper, it's very clear, right? You go to the shelf and you don't see the toilet paper. But if there's a shortage of semiconductors, no one sees it. I think that's part of the problem here.
Yeah, I think the shortage, if you think about it, we had many other shortages, right? Some of the shelves were empty in supermarket and so on. These have to do with the way supply chains are managed nowadays in general, right? Things are kept pretty tight with just-in-time delivery and so on. So I think this is not a very specific problem to the semiconductor ecosystem. It's just that I think over time, it was a very slow development, I would say over 30 years. More and more of the production has moved offshore. And it's just reached a point where we need to bring some of it back for reasons of national security and so on alone.
One of the things when I was reading about the Chips and Science Act and the larger hubs that UH is going to be a part of was this term lab to fab. So going from discoveries in the lab along that pipeline to making it fabricated so that people can buy it. And what are the stumbling blocks along the way?
This lab to fab transition has been a problem for many decades. Basically, there's many exciting developments in labs, but then transitioning that into actual products has been extremely difficult. And so part of what the CHIPS Act is trying to do is to provide funding to make this a much smoother process and to enable these transitions. And so it starts with training people in the labs. Now, actually, around the country, I would say there's a trend to have more courses that educate students right at the university in designing and fabricating chips so that when they go out and maybe start companies or they're part of research labs, they can do better or they're better equipped to make these transitions. And this is part of the strategy. So this applies to both design. There's also something called packaging where semiconductors are packaged. And then one level underneath is also the fabrication. And perhaps Jeff wants to say something about that. It's kind of his part of the initiative.
There's a big disconnect here between what's done at the university level and what's done at the industrial level. The capital investment that it takes to get a single chip into fabrication at the industrial level is huge. The companies have to invest a lot of money into this. And so taking a design that a student does or at the university level, try to port that into an industrial chip is really difficult and time consuming and costly. And so I think what the investment is trying to do, like Boris was saying, is smooth out that transition, try to increase the quality of the chips that are being designed at the lower levels, like at universities, so that when they move into industry, it's easier to transition.
What you're describing sounds a lot like the drug pipeline. So you have a discovery in the lab and it is great. And you put out a wonderful press release saying one day we might cure cancer, but then actually getting that into an approved drug is a whole nother beast. But I feel like in, for example, cancer biology, you see initiatives like this all the time, giving a lot of money. Does this happen often in the world of engineering, in the world of semiconductors?
First of all, I'd say that it's a great analogy. The cancer drug discovery is a really good analogy. It's not quite as difficult to get a chip fabricated as it is to get FDA approval on a cancer drug, but it's still a daunting process. And in my experience, there always has been government funding for semiconductor research, but this level of funding is new. This is above and beyond what we've seen in the past by quite a wide margin, I would say. So this is really exciting for us in this, in trying to train semiconductor engineers. We have two sort of projects here, both on the what we call a workforce development front. What I'm working on is what we call technician training, trying to get students to have more skills related to testing, fabricating semiconductor devices. So what we're going to set up is an internship program for UH students and community college students and so on at UH Manoa, where we can bring interns in over the summer and train them on the equipment and the techniques we have here at UH. In addition, these students are hopefully going to have the opportunity to train elsewhere, like at Stanford and UC Berkeley, in an exchange program that we're setting up so they can learn our equipment, but also the sort of more advanced equipment that they have at other universities.
Yeah, so what Jeff mentioned is related more to fabrication. But before you can fabricate something, you actually need to design it first. And so my part is the design. And so this goes into different levels of the student population. So first, I actually want to offer undergraduates an opportunity to design relatively simple chips just to get in the field and to see what it's about and maybe get excited and choose that as a career path. So in my lab, I'm basically offering right now to a few students to design what we call a tiny chip. So for one semester, they design a very small chip. They go through the logistics of it, the design of it, and they see if this is fun and if this is a career for them. And if they like it, they can move on and maybe in graduate school or later undergraduate courses, pursue this more deeply. And this is where the second part comes in. I have a fully dedicated class on chip design now where graduate students and advanced undergraduates can design their dream chip basically in my class and get it fabricated by a commercial partner. And then these chips come back a few months later and then they get tested. And students basically that way have an end-to-end experience from their own idea to the way the chip is designed and then actually validating that it functions as expected. Now, another layer on top of it is the research layer. And this is kind of where the trendy stuff comes in, like AI. So the new idea is now to actually design these chips with AI and AI algorithms. And this is also something that I'm excited about, and that becomes a research component in this whole undertaking. So I'm actually looking for more broadly, actually pull in people from computer science who are good at AI to get excited about chip design, because it turns out about 10 times more people these days are interested in AI than there are people in, you know, excited about chip design. So this is a huge pool that we're trying to pull in people from, and that's something I'm working on.
And I understand the hope nationally is that we move the offshore manufacturing and design and development of chips back to the U.S. But in Hawaii specifically, do you have any hopes when it comes to engineering here on the islands and whether graduating more students, more people interested in the profession will build that industry right here?
Boris and I talk about this all the time. How can we get more involvement from our students locally? And one of the great things about the class that Boris is teaching is that he's teaching the design principles. And you don't have to be in California or Arizona or Boston to design a chip. You can be right here in Hawaii to do the design. The manufacturing of that, it's a different story. But the design, which is a crucial part of the semiconductor process, really one of the most important parts of it, can be done anywhere. So it can be done here. And in fact, there are companies. There's a startup company here in Honolulu who does chip design. They're graduates of UH and Aldo Scientific. So the model has already been developed, and we're hoping that more and more students will take advantage of classes like Boris's and start companies based on chip design. That's the goal. Really help our economy as one of our big drivers here.
Exactly. And maybe one thing to point out, this last program component I mentioned, designing chips with AI, this is actually a very interesting startup opportunity. So if the island wants to get into kind of the frontier of where the funding goes for startups right now, this is actually an area where we could gain an edge over other places and really develop a critical infrastructure where students will be attracted to. And from then on, it could be exponential growth if it all goes well.
We've been hearing from University of Hawaii professors Jeff Weldon and Boris Merman. They spoke with HPR's Maddie Bender. UH typically graduates between 300 and 350 engineers each year. About a third of those are electrical engineers.
Days of brutal civil war in Sudan mean that a massive number of people are now food insecure.
It's catastrophic. You have half of the population right now, 25 million, who are hungry. This is literally the world's largest food crisis.
Peace talks for Sudan are taking place in Switzerland. A U.S. diplomat explains what's at stake next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Hey there, it's Sabrina Tavernisi, host of The Daily. Join us for an in-depth look at the world's biggest stories as they happen. Catch The Daily, Monday through Thursday evenings at 6:30, here on HPR One.
For four decades, the Hawaii Bicycling League has put on the Century Ride that kicks off next month. The nonprofit's also been the driving force behind making Honolulu a more cycle-friendly city. Look around, and there are more bike lanes, bike rentals, and more competition with e-bikes and e-scooters available like no other time on our roads. Travis Council is the executive director and joined us this morning to talk about the Century Ride and to reflect on how far the organization has come and where it needs to go.
Yeah, so this started in the early 1980s, and it really started just as a great way to get people biking, you know, a non-competitive large group ride, in other words. And now it's grown, obviously, since then, and we see, nearly 2,000 people participate in this event, which is one of the biggest cycling events in Hawaii, if not the largest. Non-competitive as well, so people can go the distance they want and have a great time out there.
And if I recall right, we did get a fair amount of folks from Japan as well, right?
Correct. Yeah. So we've been working with a team in Japan for over 20 years now, actually the same team that brings folks over for the marathon. And we at one point saw almost 1,000 visitors from Japan just for this ride. Of course, in recent years, post-COVID and then with the yen challenges, we've seen a drop of that. It's still a few hundred that come over and do this ride, but definitely an international, and we bring a lot of people from the mainland as well to come enjoy this ride.
Yeah, because I think the airlines even got involved to encourage riders from Japan.
Correct. Yeah, one of our largest sponsors is Japan Airlines, and they even provide a free bike voucher, so where your bike travels for free if you're flying over for this event. So great partner that we've had for a number of years.
And talk about this concept of a century ride. I mean, you folks are going to be marking your 50th anniversary for the Hawaii Bicycling League.
So a century ride, 100 miles, really an awesome accomplishment for anybody trying to get out there and challenge themselves. Of course, the nice thing with this not being a race is that you can build up to that. We have aid stations every 10 miles or so, and people can kind of choose the distance that they go. But we see a number of people that go out and do the full 100 miles out to Swansea Beach Park up above Kualoa Ranch and back to Kapiolani Park. And yeah, it's a personal accomplishment similar to that marathon effort or some other benchmark that people strive to reach.
I was just thinking about all the people who have really helped to promote cycling over the many decades. And I'm thinking of former city council members, Gary Gill and Duke Bainham, you know, and the many hands, many executive directors over the years, you know, Chad Taniguchi, Lori McCartney. It just goes on, but it really is just a community effort to promote cycling in our community.
Totally. Yeah, this is an effort that takes many hands. You mentioned many of them that, you know, Eve DeCourcy, one of our longtime executive directors, John B. Kelly, both of individuals that really carried not only HBL, but the effort for many years. And even today, you know, we have great efforts and partners at the city, as state, DOT, et cetera, that really, from a governmental side, help us move things forward, whether it's bike lanes or other initiatives, laws, et cetera. And then we look to our members and our volunteers. Just for the Century Ride alone, we rely on about 400 volunteers. That's groups at aid stations, group helping with packet pickup or delivering supplies. So it really is a team effort, not only for the event, but for this larger effort.
You know, we have seen over the years with technology that now we're seeing so many e-bikes, you know, on the road and e-scooters. You know, we've got the Beaky bike. So, you know, we've got complete streets, but there's a bit of sharing that needs to go on. And so how are you folks looking at the advent of technology and just promoting safe cycling?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And in recent years, it used to be, you know, bike, walk, drive, or maybe the bus, kind of those four modes. And now they've added a lot of different technologies. You mentioned, you know, scooters or one wheels or electric bikes or skateboards with motors, et cetera. And I think you said it right, that it really is about sharing the road with Aloha. We do have limited space here, but you know, we're all people. We're all looking to get where we're going safely. And really, it comes down to us that, you know, sharing with Aloha, maybe slowing down a little bit, being aware of people around you. And we are working with the government on that side to kind of catch up with some of the definitions and enforcements and rules to better define where everybody should be. But kind of until that gets smoothed out, we really need to emphasize the sharing the space with everybody.
I was over at Skyline, you know, the rail project recently, and saw so many people bringing scooters or their bikes. And you folks have organized a number of events to get on the train.
Yeah, I think, you know, we recently did a bike to the historic train ride, this one out in Eva Beach, and actually used the rail as an option for people to check that out and kind of do either a bike ride first and then take the rail back. The air conditioning was nice. And I think what you mentioned is, you know, we're seeing a lot of people use different transportation modes to really go what they call multimodal. So where you either walk or bike or take the bus or a combination of those pieces. And this new technology is really making that possible. A scooter can get you someplace a little quicker than driving or maybe transportation wise. And I think that's a great mix. It's this option, just giving people more ways so that, you know, we're not all sitting in traffic. There's other ways to get out there and get where you need to go in different ways.
And the Hawaii Bicycling League, I know, has a number of different groups that help to encourage cycling. I know Malia had the trikes, right, for seniors.
Correct,
over there at Blaisdell Park. That was a fun story to cover.
Yes, Malia's our director of adult education, and we've had the senior cycling before, as you mentioned, and our newest effort is actually around the electric bikes upcoming in September. We have a number of e-bike 101 classes funded by the DOT, to really give people the skills and knowledge as this emerging technology comes out, to feel confident in the safety, but also in knowing what they're purchasing, what considers a bicycle versus electric motorcycle or anything of those things, just to get better clarification out there. So we're expanding our education to really match that new technology.
Where are we at with Complete Streets?
So, you know, the city Complete Streets projects are numerous. I think every neighborhood probably has either a plan or an active project going on. And just recently, the city adopted their Vision Zero plan. So this is an effort to get down to zero traffic fatality, which Complete Streets is an effort within that larger effort. So we're big fans of Complete Streets. It really is an effort to look at our roadways from more than just a vehicle pathway, where we say, hey, you know, there's people walking, biking, there's buses, there's cars. Let's kind of look at this from a complete standpoint. And it does take time. Infrastructure projects are not something that can really occur overnight. But the city does have a lot of plans and a lot of efforts that when a rehab of a road comes up, hopefully we can improve that and take the plan and put it into place.
And the communities have really been stepping up. I know they're on the North Shore. you know, working to spruce up the bike path over there. You've got efforts on the west side, you know, just that whole connectivity thing.
Yeah, I think we've seen a lot of people that say, hey, you know, there's different ways to get around than sitting in traffic, or, hey, we've had injuries or fatalities in our neighborhoods. We want to see improvements, whether those are the raised crosswalks or flashing lights or separated paths. There's a lot of great efforts, as you mentioned. The North Shore bike path is getting repaved and ultimately expanded, we hope. We're working with a couple organizations up there to find some better ways for people to get around. We're all, unfortunately, in a rush to get where we need to go, and hopefully we can slow down a little bit and have some better options.
And, you know, the pandemic, I know, really put a crimp in so many events and so many businesses. And I know Beaky Bikes, that faltered a bit in some areas. And I know the city has taken over that.
Yeah, yeah. So with Beaky moving to basically being managed by the city, still secure bike share operating the actual system. But I think that was a good move ultimately, that the city has a little more ability to go after some of these federal funds and transportation funds to really start looking at Beaky as a core component of our transportation system. You mentioned earlier, you know, people using scooters and things. I think Beaky's a great option for people for that last mile, or maybe just a quick lunch meeting, or like you said, it was and continues to be popular for tourists and visitors as well. So I think with it under the city's management, there's a lot of opportunity there that might not have been there when it was separate from them. So excited to see what that opportunity is. HBL has been a strong supporter since it started, and we've even done Beaky 101 classes to teach people how to use it and those types of things. So we're excited to continue to promote that and work with the city on expanding its operations ultimately.
Is there anything you want to leave our listeners with when it comes to safety? You know, because as we see more of these motorized vehicles out on the streets, so many people are not wearing helmets, and that worries me.
Yeah, no, I think safety is a really important message. I think for us, our main advocacy push is safe streets for all. We're all people. It's not us versus them. It's not bikes versus cars. We're all people, and we all want to get where we're going. So, of course, helmets, we definitely recommend helmets for bikes, scooters, et cetera. But the main thing to me is just looking out for each other. Put the phone down. Make sure you're paying attention, especially when you're driving a car. They can quickly do damage if you're not. So the main thing to me is we're all people. Let's share the road with Aloha.
Okay. Well, Travis Council, thank you so much. I appreciate your time this morning.
Of course, and hope to see you at the Century Ride next month.
And that was Travis Council, Executive Director of the Hawaii Bicycling League, talking to us about all things related to cycling. And reminder, if you plan to take part in the Hawaii Century Ride, registration fees go up after tomorrow. We'll have links on the conversation page of our website later today. That is it for us for this hour. Up tomorrow, with the Labor Day holiday on the horizon, we have a Hanaho show for you around conversations that we've had with people that we think have some pretty darn interesting jobs. Give us some feedback. Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation segments on our website or as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or Google. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.